Our friends from Canada, will Amirtsem join us in about 15 minutes? They're davening Musaf now in Canada for Rosh Chodesh. I'm going to wish you a happy Chodesh, a Chodesh of Nechama, as we enter into Chodesh Av. I find...
Are you going to wait for Canada?
No. They're going to join us. But you have to be patient. They'll join us in 15 minutes.
Okay.
What I find is that there are many, many halachic issues that you and I wouldn't have dreamed of that have come up during the last period of 4 or 5 months since we started with this coronavirus. And what fascinates me as a Ben Torah is the fact that the halacha has to respond to all these new situations and new questions that come up. And it just sends a shudder up my spine to become more and more aware of how endless the Torah is, how the principles of the Torah can foresee almost anything in the future, anything down the line. Imagine issues that have come up now, some of them are based on modern technology, and of course because of this virus, and the halacha is just capable of answering all these questions. It reminds me when back in my youth when I was learning how to play tennis, they used to have this machine, I don't know if you remember, it would just throw the balls like one after the other and then you just hit the balls. It's amazing to me how the halacha is able to constantly, you know, hit the balls right on. Now, what's new for today is, and I hope that if you're on the list, if not, I'll put you on the list, you can receive by email these Mar Makomos, is an essay called Magefat HaKorona, which was authored by Rav Yitzhak Zilberstein, who I've quoted in the past, but I've never seen an amalgamation of his tshuvas in one essay. And today I'd like to focus on 4 pages from this very long kuntras. In addition, and I'll be introducing his questions in just a moment, I would like to mention a new gilyon, a new edition of Omek HaPshat that just came out a week ago. It's number 273, and hopefully you've received that. And that has to do with answering the phone on Shabbos if you're waiting for the results of a corona test. And we'll see that there are various issues that come up that are a result of knowing the answer to that test, to that examination that you took, and they're very crucial issues. Our friends from Canada will join us in about 15 minutes. They're davening Musaf now for Rosh Chodesh. I'm going to continue with the shiur as scheduled. And the shiur might go a little bit later today. That's up to you if you could stay on. And that's in order to accommodate the Torontonians. Rav Shechter Shlita has come up with a couple of new tshuvas, one of which I thought was interesting, about washing on Tisha B'Av this year. Now we paskin that we don't wash the hands on Tisha B'Av, not even at bow, not even one finger in water, and not only hot water is prohibited, but even cold water. And that's the final psak that's codified in the laws of Tisha B'Av, Tuf, Kuf Nun Dalet. However, every rule has its an exception, and the Shulchan Aruch paskins that in 2 cases you're allowed to wash your hands, and for that matter any part of your body. And that is Yodav Meluchlachos, if his hands are filthy with either tit, which is some sort of cement or clay, or tsoa or excrement. In those cases, we allow you not to wash your hands, but to wash whatever part of your hands or any part of your body which has to be cleaned. And the reason for this is because we categorize such washing not as rechitza shel tainug, which of course is prohibited to enjoy the benefits of washing, but rather as a rechitza lahasir, to remove lichluch. And the poskim go a step further. They allow you to wash your hands in the morning when you wake up. We call it negel vasser, in order to remove the so-called ruach ra'ah. And again, in all these cases, you wash what's absolutely necessary, and it's not a violation of rechitza on Tisha B'Av. B'shas ha-magefa, now that we're facing this pandemic, he says, Adayin, he says it's still a situation of exposure to the germs that might either infect somebody or he might infect someone else. And therefore, he says, we're allowed to wash our hands on Tisha B'Av, lefi atzorech, according to the need. But here, he has a very fascinating breakdown. And he says that there are two categories of people. He says one category of people are very, very concerned about this disease, and I think he applauds them, and they want to follow all of the guidelines and the recommendations of the Board of Health, etc., etc. In every country it's different. In America it's called the CDC. And they are so afraid of this disease that they wear masks whenever they're outside, and the masks cover not only their mouths but also their nose. And they consider the situation to be safek sakana, and it's a dangerous situation. And for them, he says there's an allowance, because they're so careful about these recommendations, there's an allowance to wash their hands on Tisha B'Av. And he goes on to expand that heter to include using disinfectants to clean his hands of any possible germs. And that's because for them, it's a safek sakana. And it's no different than yadav meluchlachos petit. But then he has another category of people who he says rely on what's called shomer psayim Hashem. He doesn't go into detail. I'll just fill in a little bit of background. The Gemara speaks about a pregnant woman, and when she's having intimate relations with her husband, she's allowed to use contraception, which is called in the Gemara's language a moch, some sort of a sponge that she used to absorb the semen. And the reason for it is because she might come into danger if she gets pregnant the second time. So although it's rare for such a thing to occur, but it is possible, and it could certainly be damaging and dangerous for the fetus, and therefore she's allowed to use contraception. The Gemara then rejects it and applies a principle which is derived from Shlomo HaMelech called Shomer Psoyim Hashem, that Hashem protects those who are Psoyim. Psoyim means they have emunah, they have faith, and they rely on Hashem. So whenever the danger is considered a little bit low statistical probability, then even though the halacha will advocate in favor of taking all precautions, there is a category of people called Shomer Psoyim Hashem, that Hashem will watch over these people. By the way, just as a historical curiosity, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his first tshuva regarding smoking, this was before the Surgeon General's recommendation came out, he actually said, because smoking was so, so rampant, especially in yeshivot at that time, that we can apply the principle of Shomer Psoyim Hashem. And the poskim say that if you cross the street and you might get hit by a car. Shomim P'soyim Hashem. Those who are relying on Hashem in a very naive, in a positive sense, a naive way, they'll be protected. Again, keep in mind, Rav Shecht is by far not advocating in favor of that group of people and that attitude, but he says that they're relying on their poskim, and for them, he says, there's no leniency on Tisha B'Av to wash their hands. The Elu Shein Choshishin, those who are not concerned with the recommendations and so forth, he says, Lo Nizharim, they're not careful about Kol HaHisrachakut, all this distancing. V'sharin Yoni Zehir, so he says, L'datom Shayach Kan Lomar Shom P'soim Hashem, is therefore, Ein Lehem L'nakos Es Yedehem, they should not be using any sort of water or disinfectants to wash their hands. Now, in another tshuva, Rav Shechter addresses the question of shaving and of listening to music during this period of time. And he mentions, which I'm not sure if I ever mentioned this in the past, Rav Soloveitchik has a principle that any minog in Klal Yisrael has to fit into some sort of halachic framework. Otherwise, it has no backbone, it has no significance. We can't add new minhagim unless they fit into some framework. And in the case of what we call Avelus Yeshana, which means Avelus for the Churban Abayis, there are three halachic categories. There's the 3 weeks that begins with Shivasa B'Tammuz and takes us till Rosh Chodesh Av. Rosh Chodesh Av is the second category. And finally, Tisha B'Av is the most intense. The first category, again beginning with Shavuos B'Tammuz, is called, or parallels, Yud Beis Chodesh Al Aviv V'Imo. It's like someone who lost a parent, and he has 12 months of Avelus. Then we get to Tisha B'Av, the 9 days, or for Sfaradim, it's called Shavuos Shachalbo, and that is a more intense stage of Avelus, that's called, or parallels, I should say, a Shloshim period. And then finally we get to Tisha B'Av, which is like Shiva. That's the most intense Avelus. Now, with regard to Yud Beis Chodesh, the halacha of shaving or taking haircuts is all dependent upon something called Ad Shi'igaru Bo Chaverov, until his friends would say to him, you know, you look awful, take a shave, take a haircut. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, in one of his tshuvas, claims that this is a very subjective criterion, and it really reflects, it's relative to every individual. How often does a person normally take a haircut? And he says what you should do is, if you normally take a haircut from, let's say, 1 month to the next, let's say, I'm just giving you an example, then you multiply it by three, I'm sorry, you multiply it by two, and instead of waiting 1 month, you wait kefel, you wait 2 months. Now, based on that, Rav Shechter paskins that if Rav Soloveitchik's definition is to be accepted, then if a person shaves his beard on a regular basis, or, for example, he shaves once a week or so, then we would just have to double that, multiply it by two, and that would be considered Achiyagaru Bo Chaverov. He doesn't have to actually wait until his friend, you know, calls him up and says, hey, take a haircut, take a shave. As far as music is concerned, here Rav Shechter really puts himself out, and he claims that the prohibition of listening to music by virtue of this minog during the 3 weeks is limited to what he calls music for the sake of pleasure. Kedei l'sameach, in order to rejoice. So people like to hear music and like to dance around. That, by virtue of minog, is prohibited from the 17th of Tammuz and on. However, he says that during this period of Corona, which he calls and categorizes as Mora Shchora V'Atzvus. He says that for many people who have been basically quarantined, we'll call it even self-quarantined, for months upon months, they get into a state of anxiety, or chas v'shalom, even depression. And here he says that the music is not for the purpose of simcha, to put him into a period of joy, a state of joy, but rather to remove anxiety and depression. Again, a very interesting and subtle distinction. You know, one is kind of positive and the other is the negative of a negative. The positive for the sake of simcha. You know, I want to listen to music to dance and sing, hoopla. That's prohibited. But if my purpose, and everybody has to be honest and subjective about it, is not to dance and sing, but simply to break up that thick, heavy state of despair. And he says that machmas hamagefa sheposhta b'chol olam kulo ha'olam shari b'tzar. He says the world is in a state of tzar, and therefore, if we have to dispel or assuage those feelings of tzar, and that's why we're listening to music. He says, Nira sheyesh lahakil b'zeh, it seems to me, he writes, that we could be more lenient about that. But, now, I don't know if I've mentioned to you, I think I have, but just a very quick review, at least for me it's always good to review. He's worried about Rosh Hashanah. He thinks that we're going to have to break up into smaller groups in order to facilitate the masses of people, Baruch Hashem, that want to come to daven on Rosh Hashanah, but we have to break up into groups. And not every synagogue has 50 million rooms where you could have different minyanim on Rosh Hashanah going on simultaneously. And therefore, he envisions the need, he says, minyan shal hashkama, one earlier minyan. And that minyan has to daven very quickly, because a Rosh Hashanah davening can take 3-4 hours, as you know, and maybe even twice that amount. And therefore, if you have to make way for the next minyan, so he imagines the regular minyan at 9 a.m., so you've got a minyan at 7, and after they clear out, we can start the minyan at 9, and therefore the minyan has 2 hours maximum. So we're going to have to cut it down. So he suggests three different ways of cutting down, abridging the Rosh Hashanah davening. And again, this should not be confused with the conservative movement. You know, we're not out here to abridge the davening, but it's a shas hadchak, it's a magefa, and we could do it in three ways, and maybe A, B, plus C. First, he says, to follow the Brisker tradition and leave out piyutim. The reason why the Soloveitchiks left out piyutim is because of hefsek tkios, that we don't want to add things that are not part of the critical, integral nusach ha-tfilah, because that's going to cause an interruption and wedge between the tkios. The only one of the piyutim which the Soloveitchiks will always recite is ha-oches biyad midas mishpat, which apparently dates back to who knows when, maybe even the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Nesad HaTokef is relatively much earlier than that. And he says that's one way of cutting down the minyan by leaving out, by omitting the piyutim. I would guess that, maybe I'm exaggerating, but the piyutim might add as much as an hour to davening. I don't know. I mean, again, that depends on the chazanim, I suppose. The second possibility is to cut down the tkios. Now, we have a minig of blowing 100 tkios, and he says that's a minog. And just like it's a minog to recite piyutim, it's a minog to blow 100 tkios. And in both cases, he says, we can put aside the minog in this shas adchak for the sake of cutting down the davening so that the next minion can come in. And he says that we basically need two sets of tkios, that's critical. There are what's called the tkios to be yushav after we recite the brachas, that's before we start musav, and that's a group of 30 tkios. Then you have another 30 tkios that are integrated into the chazaras hashatz, which are called tkios al seder brachos, and those are critical. So we'll cut down the tkios from 100 down to 60. Now he raises a question parenthetically whether we need hataras nedarim. And there are those poskim who say that whenever you violate a minog, you need a hataras nedarim. He says in this case, based on the Nodav Yehuda, the Dogel Mevav, we don't need hataras nedarim because the minog was only accepted for not a shas adchak, but for normal times. Now the third approach to cutting down the time in davening is very, very tricky and very complicated. And that's called Lekatzer Bipsuke de Zimra. Now, he says that he heard about shuls where they only show up on Shabbos for Shochein Ad, or earliest for Nishmas, and he's not comfortable with that, because he writes that there is a hefsek when you start the first bracha, Baruch Sha'amar, between that bracha and coming to shul in order to recite the last bracha when you complete Psukei de Zimra. However, he does mention that there seems to have been a tradition that goes back to Rav Moshe Leib Sasever, one of the great Hasidic giants, who himself was not only a Rebbe but served as a Shliach Tzibur, that on Shabbos and Yontif he would begin with Nishmas Kol Chai. Now it's unclear, I read this over five times to try to figure out what he means. When did Rav Moshe Leib Sasever recite the bracha of Yishtabach? I don't know, it's not clear to me. Perhaps he means that he would recite most of Psukei de Zimra without a bracha, then make the bracha, and then start Nishmas. I don't know. The language I'll read to you, he says, Maschil mitchilas habracha minishmas kol chai. He begins the beginning of the bracha with Nishmas kol chai. What do you mean? Nishmas kol chai has no bracha. So I don't know what he means over here. I get the feeling, again, it's just my imagination perhaps, that he would postpone the bracha that opens Psukei de Zimra until Nishmas, and the rest he would say without a bracha. I don't know. He doesn't tell you. But he does write that Eino nochon lelechas mi beso lebeis haknesses barachov b'emtza bracha. He says it's not right to walk from his house to the shul in the middle of a bracha. So that's, he leaves that as problematic. Okay, Rabosai, I see our first Torontonian has joined us. Joe, I'll wish you a Chodesh Tov. And now I want to get to the meat and potatoes of today's Shia. And that is two fascinating tshuvas that I found here. And Torah is so broad, from Rav Silverstein. And you may know that I'm a big fan of Rav Silverstein. I've quoted him in the past. In this case, I'm very excited about one of his two tshuvas. In the other tshuva, I'm a little bit skeptical, but I'll quote both of them. So hopefully you've printed this out. You got it in the email. I want to thank David, as I always do, for sending this around. He opens his tshuva with a quiz question. He calls it a puzzle, a chidah. He says, when is a nurse obligated to wear a nursing outfit according to Torah law? And he says the following. During the height of the epidemic, everything was pikuach nefesh. Every person who was part of the staff, the medical staff, was absolutely critical. And on Shabbos, a nurse, by the way, the word achot could be a male nurse as well. I just have this suspicion, I have no way of knowing this, that he's referring to a female nurse. But in any event, he says that the nurse has to come to the hospital on Shabbos. He calls it Ribui HaCholim. There are so many ill people. This is certainly clearly Pikuach Nefesh. He says the hospital has arranged that a non-Jew will pick her up and drive her to the hospital on Shabbos. So far, everything sounds smooth. But, there's always a but. According to the strict rules of the health authorities, the driver should be picking up no more than one nurse at a time. However, because of the tremendous, he calls it behala, you know, this overwhelming confusion and urgency of the situation, the driver is picking up, he doesn't tell you exactly how many, but he says, "Biglalat chifutu masia yoter me'achot achat." More than one nurse is going to be in this tender, in this car, on the way to the hospital. Now, this particular nurse, oh yeah, I know that it's a female because he writes pochedet in the feminine, she is absolutely freaked out. Because she thinks that if there's more than one a nurse, that severely increases. Again, this is the time, the height of the epidemic. And Shema Lote Mugenes Hetiv, she might not be protected in terms of her own health. Without blinking, Rav Zilberstein assumes that the halacha will take into consideration her fear, and we don't poo-poo it at all, because again, according to the strict rules, he should be taking, if things were normal, only one nurse in the car. And he says there's no question that she's allowed and even obligated to drive her own car if that's the only way she could get to the hospital. Again, if they have another driver who's not Jewish, that's a different story. But if there's only one driver available who could take her and he's taking another nurse, and how much more so if there's more than one nurse, she gets into a car and she drives. And now he says that she should make sure to wear her nursing outfit. Why? And he quotes a tshuva from the Chazon Ish, and I've told you many, many times the Chazon Ish was like the powerhouse of Psak here in Eretz Yisrael for a long period of decades upon decades. And he paskin about the case of a religious man who, for pikuach nefesh reasons, has to drive to a hospital on Shabbos, that he should wear his talis. And that sounds pretty weird. In other words, I'm about to get into an ambulance or a car on Shabbos, and I should first put on my talis. Why? He says, "Kedesha lo yechil Hashem," because people might suspect him of violating the Shabbos. And once they see that he's a religious Jew, he's wearing a talis, they'll know that for sure it's pikuach nefesh. And Rav Zilberstein applies the same logic here to the case of the nurse. She should be wearing her nursing outfit. Once the people see her in the uniform, they'll realize that she's not stam violating the Shabbos, but she's doing it and driving there in her own personal car for pikuach nefesh. That itself is a chiddush, which I found exciting. But the next piece in the same tshuva I thought was even more exciting. And he writes the following, that the law requiring special clothes for Shabbos, that I shouldn't be wearing my weekday clothes on Shabbos, or at least one of my articles of clothing that I'm wearing on Shabbos should be different than what I wear during the week, that law is codified in Shulchan Aruch in two different simanim. It's in Siman Reish Samach Beis, Yesh Mitzvah Lilbosh Beged Miyuchad L'Shabbos Mishum Mitzvahs V'Chibadito. Right, this is a mitzvah that's derived from Yeshayahu Navi, and we have to give respect and glory to the day of Shabbos by wearing special clothing. However, in a different Siman, which is Siman Shin Aleph, the Ramah writes, Lo Yetze Odom V'Shabbos K'moshu Yotze B'Chol Bilti Dovar Acher. He says there should be one other thing that he wears that's not equal to what he wears during the week. And if I take a breath now and cover the next part of the Ramah, you would expect him to say, because of the mitzvah of the Kibadato. And then you would ask me, well, why does he repeat himself? He's already committed to that. But that's not what he says. He says, Kidei sheyizkar al yado shu Shabbos v'lo yavo l'chalol. If a person wears, says the Rambam, the same exact clothes that he wears in a weekday on Shabbos, he may forget that it's Shabbos. Yeah, he's wearing his baseball cap and, I don't know, the maple leaves, whatever he wears, and he may actually forget that it's Shabbos. This is a whole different halacha. It's not b'toras kovin, but b'toras zecher. It's a memory device to make sure that he feels Shabbos on him. And he writes the following. As far as this nurse is concerned, you might argue that she doesn't have the mitzvah of a kibadato because we've already paskened for that she should be wearing her nursing uniform to make sure that everybody knows why she's driving to the hospital on Shabbos. But, he says, she has to be very careful. He calls it lahakpid yeser, even more than other people, on this halacha. Why? Because now she's going to be thrust into a situation in which she's going to be constantly bombarded by challenges of Chil Shabbos. She's going to have to override the Shabbos in many, many different ways during this Shabbos when she's in the hospital because of Pikuach Nefesh. It's critical that she remember it Shabbos. And she should definitely wear at least something that's Shabbistic that'll remind her that today is Shabbos. And perhaps, although this is just a footnote on my part, he's implying that there may be situations in which she doesn't have Pikuach Nefesh. You know, let's say, for example, she has to use the facilities, you know, go to the toilet, and she inadvertently open the lights. I mean, that's not Pikuach Nefesh. And therefore, she has to have something to remind her that it's Shabbos. I mean, how much more so? Number one, she is working in her weekday environment in the milieu of the hospital. She's wearing her weekday begadim because she's wearing her nursing uniform. And on top to boot, she'll have situations flying at her from every direction of Chil Shabbos. She has to be extremely careful to wear at least one garment that'll remind her of Shabbos. I thought this was fascinating because, honestly, it's based on what I call a lumdish approach to Shulchan Aruch. Why did the Rambam have to repeat himself and tell me that you have to wear one beged of Shabbos on Shabbos if the rest of your begadim are all ordinary weekday begadim? And the Rambam brings it down twice. And you and I know that if we learn the Shulchan Aruch and the halacha is brought down twice, it's two different halachas. And he says if you read the Rambam meticulously, you'll see that this is an entirely different halacha, has nothing to do with the kibadito. I would even go as far as to say that the kibadito maybe would only apply to begadim that could be nikah, which could be seen from the outside. But this maybe even if no one could see it. You know, maybe you're wearing something underneath your jacket, but you know you see it and no one else sees it. That would be a fulfillment of the other halacha, which the Rambam codifies in Siman Shin Aleph about a zecher to make sure that a person realizes that it's Shabbos.
So, well, maybe it's not necessarily just the beged. Would it be anything?
In other words, I was thinking, you know, a flag. I mean, maybe she should put a flag that says today is Shabbos. I don't know.
Or a tie thing. Like, yeah. Any kind of simon we have at the table for...
Yeah, well, not at the table. I mean, she's got to keep it on her body because she's constantly...
I'm saying by nidon, so see, by that kind of stuff.
No, you mean like a simon ledover, you mean? Oh.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good example of precedent of a simon. Okay, question number two. Again in Rav Zilberstein, if you have it, it's on page 4. And this takes us from page 4 to page 7. He claims that this is an actual question. Again, I discussed this with my wife, and she says, come on, this couldn't be. This was just made up for the tshuva. But the language is, she'lashit ora b'tkufa sakarona. Maisa shahoya. He gives names of Reuven and Shimon. I don't think those names are accurate, but he's telling us that the story actually happened. Reuven and Shimon live in a community where there's no local moel, very far away from the nearest moel. You could imagine certain countries in Europe or other small islands where there are Jews, but they're very far from Israel or wherever it might be where they can get a moel. And Reuven's wife gives birth on a Tuesday. Keep in mind, on a Tuesday. There are no allowances for airline companies to fly anyone into the country, and certainly not a moel. So when Reuven, he's so thrilled that his wife gave birth, he's so excited about the bris milah, he contacts a few possible moelim who under normal conditions would make the trek, he pays for it, they make the trek, they all refuse, they say, look, there's nothing we can do. Then he finds out, again, it sounds like a made-up story, but he says it happened, that Shimon, who lives in that same small Jewish community, far-flung, far away, Shimon's wife gave birth on Monday, just the day before. The difference being that Shimon is a multi-millionaire, I mean, that's just my language, and he can afford a private plane to bring a moel in. So Reuven contacts Shimon, and after wishing him a great mazel tov, he says, would you mind if the moel would stay another, 24 hours or whatever it is, or maybe even less, overnight, so that the following day, on Tuesday, he can kill a second bird with this one trip and circumcise my son. Well, guess what? Every moel that they contacted was so overwhelmed that they were willing to get on a private jet, do the mila, and get back on the jet. No time to waste. So now Reuven turns to Shimon and he begs him, is there any way that you would be willing to postpone the bris by one day from Monday to Tuesday? Now keep in mind, Rabosai, you can never have a bris before the eighth day. It's meaningless. But you could have a bris beyond the eighth day. You are missing the special status, for those who are learning Daf Yomi, you'll know what I'm talking about. These are the sugyas we're learning, called Mila Bizmana. Reuven asks Shimon, would you be willing to forego on Mila Bizmana for the sake of my son's Mila? Now, again, in a certain sense, Reuven gains more than he loses because he's going to get a meal of his man on that Tuesday. But that's not what he's trying to do. He's not trying to undermine Shimon's position here and remove Shimon's mitzvah. Shimon contacts Rav Zilberstein and asks him, what should I do? I can't afford, even though he's a multimillionaire, I can't afford bringing in another moel for my friend Reuven on Tuesday. So I'm only going to bring in one moel. Do I have the obligation to forego the mitzvah of Mila Bizmana for the sake of Reuven's Mila? Meaning, otherwise we're going to have to wait who knows how long. I'm guessing, again, please, I shouldn't be posei apeh l'satan, but I have a suspicion in my bones that Reuven's son is still not gemalt. Because the situation with flying is, as you know, is very, very tight, very complicated. And
you gave up the answer.
What?
You gave up the answer. You gave away the answer.
Oh. Okay. So Rav Zilberstein says the following, that this question came up in another context. In fact, it came up in a very, very interesting way in the case of the mitzvah of tefillin. A tourist, a Jewish tourist, came to the Soviet Union with his pair of tefillin. And under the Soviets, the Jews in that particular area, I don't know, he doesn't tell you what city it was in, did not have tefillin. They begged this man to leave the tefillin behind. And hundreds, if not thousands of Jews would use those tefillin for who knows how long. And says Rav Zilberstein that although this Jewish tourist, so to speak, who visited Russia, visited Soviet Union event, was willing to leave his tefillin behind, so it was not a financial issue or any of that, he told the Rav, and this Shiloh came to Rav Zilberstein, that he would miss one day of tefillin. Meaning, because of the travel and getting back home, there would be no way that he can get tefillin on the next day. So he'd be leaving his tefillin behind in the Soviet Union for the benefit of all those Jews. And he would miss one day of tefillin. Now, you know, whenever I read a tshuva, I sort of try to invoke what I call my own intuitive sense before I look at the answer. And here I had a machlokas with my wife. She thought, no way, no how. He doesn't have to give up his tefillin. And I thought, no way, no how. He has to give up his tefillin. She was right and I was wrong. And this is an example of the halachic mind that's not necessarily intuitive. Why should I not give up one day of tefillin for so many Jews to wear tefillin on a long basis? I mean, just intuitively, it didn't make sense to me. You know, the halacha is v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Just give me 1 minute, Joe. Comes along Rav Zilberstein, and he writes a tshuva that he should not leave his tefillin behind. And he bases himself on two principles. One principle is the famous Gemara in Masechta Bava Metzia about two people going in the desert, and Rabbi Akiva codifies the halacha of Chayecha Kodman. And the second principle is that he, the tourist who has tefillin, he's obligated in tefillin. The Jews in the Soviet Union are not obligated in tefillin because they don't have tefillin. And when he combines A plus B, he comes to the conclusion that not only is this Jew exempt from giving his tefillin over to the community, he's not even allowed to do so because he is obligated in tefillin and he has to wear his tefillin. And in my mind, this was a profound example of halacha being what I call counterintuitive. Halacha works with principles. And many people who, and in this case I would have to describe myself as one of those, are ignorant of the nuances of halacha and the principles by which it operates, and they come to conclusion, they paskin for themselves, they wouldn't even call up a rabbi to ask the shiloh, and the rabbi is either great enough to disprove their thesis, or if not, he's great enough to know that this is a shiloh that has to be taken to one of the greats, who knows the in and outs of halacha, and we got to get a psak. Joe, go ahead. You wanted to say something? I'm sorry.
No, that was
all right.
Exactly. I want to ask just if it was... Sorry.
Anyway, let me just say the following. In his tshuva, Rav Zilberstein refers to a Mishnah Berurah. I never would believe in a million years that the Mishnah Berurah would have addressed such a question, but the Mishnah Berurah speaks about a person who has an esrog, and there's a certain city which has no esrog. Now, if he ships off his esrog to that city, it's not that he won't be able to fulfill the mitzvah of esrog, he'll be yotze with what's called the esrog of the kahal. However, the Mishnah Berurah quotes a Machzis HaShekel, one of the later poskim, who says that Rov Pa'amim, in most cases, Li'achar Avarei Z'yom Me'achag, Alidei Rov Mishmush B'nei Odom, HaEsrog Shalakol Miskalkel. And my father, Zichron Levok, used to describe the situation in his little shtetl, you know, back 100 years ago. And that's what happened. They had one Esrog for the entire community, if they were lucky. And people wait online for their turn to shake the lulav. All four minim, they're very rare. But what happened is that because the whole Kahal would use it, inevitably almost, it would get ruined by the time. So basically, if I give up my Esrog, then at some point, I will have forfeited my mitzvah. But for the sake of the Kahal, in a nearby town, where there's not even one Esrog for the entire community. And the Mishnah Berurah says that he doesn't give up his Esrog. He holds on to his own Esrog. Chayecha Kodman. And Heim Pturim, they in the nearby town are exempt from the mitzvah. They don't have access to the Dalet Minim, and therefore they are a nusin. He has a third case where two people each have a half a zayas of matzah. And the question is, does one give up his half a zayas of matzah for the benefit of the others? And he has a psak here from his father-in-law, that's Rav Yoshev, Olav Shalom, and Rav Yoshev Paskin, that we hold that even half a zayas is a mitzvah, it's not the full mitzvah, and therefore you don't give up your half a zayas even for the sake of your friend who will fulfill a complete mitzvah. And based on this, he comes to the conclusion that the tourist that we mentioned earlier should take his tefillin home with him, not leave it there in Russia. The Russians are now potter, they don't have tefillin. And by the same token, Shimon is going to use that flyby, Moel to, bring him in his private jet on Monday to fulfill the mitzvah of Mila Bizmana. And Shimon has, and Reuven, excuse me, has no way of fulfilling the mitzvah of Mil. At the end of this tshuva, fascinating, he quotes a Gemara, which is brought down in a few places, in Brachos and elsewhere, about Rabbi Eliezer, who came into shul, and there were 9 people. They needed a 10th, and Rabbi Eliezer had a very trustworthy and reliable Eved. The Torah says you're not allowed to free your Eved, but he was Meshachrer, his Eved, so his Eved now would make up the minyan. And once again, the question is, why would he, it's almost like a Kal v'chomer, he's going to violate a lotasef for the sake of Yenim's mitzvah. So some want to say because he also wanted the mitzvah of Tefillah B'Tzibur. But Rav Zilberstein has a whole other take on it. And he comes to the conclusion that the halacha changes between a lotasef and an essay, but in the following direction. That for a lotasef, we're going to say that you give up on this lotaseh, instead of adhering to the admonition that the Torah enjoins you to free your Eved, for the sake of the Rabbim, you're going to give up on that, whereas for a mitzvah, you wouldn't do so. Now that's counterintuitive. Again, another case of a psak halacha, which seems to undermine our intuition. And he says the following, that when it comes to a lotaseh, if the halacha allows you to violate that lotasa, to free your eved, for the sake of the rabbim, that they should have a minyan to daven b'tzibur, then he says, you're not considered in violation of the law. But in a case of a mitzvah's essay, let's say, for example, tefillin, or mila that we discussed earlier, in these cases, he says, when you're dealing with the mitzvah saseh, yeah, it could be that you're potur because you're doing it for the sake of the greater good, giving them your esrog or giving them all over to Reuven. That's wonderful, but you're missing the mitzvah. And ones, circumstances mitigating that are beyond your control, cannot create a mitzvah for you. The Torah wants the mitzvah. And it reminds me of Essay Dochalosa said that from a certain perspective, again, this is very complicated, very profound, an essay is more powerful and trumps a lotasa. And therefore, in the cases that we mentioned of tefillin and esrog, where we're dealing with an essay, there you're not going to give up your essay for the sake of someone else's essay, even if it's many, many people, because you're obligated in the essay. And even if we could come up with some sort of svara to exempt you under these circumstances, but nevertheless you will not have the essay, and the Torah wants you to have the essay. In the case of Rabbi Lazar with the, you know, freeing his eved, that's a lotus. And the Torah says that you have not violated the lotus. Now, if you have the Omek HaPshat, which again, I want to thank David for circulating that. And we mentioned at the outset that we would talk about number 273, which is last week's edition of Omek HaPshat. And this week's edition is supposed to come out today, but I don't have access to that. He wants to know if you're allowed to answer the phone on Shabbos when you took a test for Corona and the Board of Health or whoever it is, here it's Mada, it's Kupat Cholim, or it's the Misrad HaBriyut, whatever it is, they're calling you to give you the results of the test. Now, it's interesting. He says that the powers at large will not call you if they know that you're a Shomer Shabbat unless the results are positive. So to call you up and tell you that it's negative, they'll wait till after Shabbat. It's very interesting. That's a reality I was unfamiliar with. But if you're positive, you tested positive, they will call you on Shabbos. Now, the purpose of their calling you on Shabbos is twofold. Number one, to notify you that you are infected. And number two, to find out and drill you as to who could have possibly had contact with you over a certain period of time. More recently, let's say, again, it's complicated because it depends whether you had symptoms, you didn't have symptoms, but anyway, to make sure that we can track down those who have to go into bidut, and they have to be quarantined. Now, you might ask me, how do I know who's calling on the phone? But I went through this, because, you know, I had corona, I'm one of those guys who had corona, I didn't have any symptoms, but I'm in a group of about, like, 25,000 people here in this country, so it's not so rare. And I knew exactly who was calling me and when. I mean, you know, you saw it on the number. So you know now two things. You know the phone is ringing on Shabbos. There are a whole bunch of malachas that you might be violating if you answer the phone. And even if you have automatic answer service, it could be that speaking into the phone is itself a violation of Shabbos. That's complicated. You know that they're calling you, and you know they're calling you to notify you that you are positive, that you tested positive. Should you answer the phone? And again, he has four pages on this. He begins with Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, our favorite Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, who paskins that he should answer the phone bishinui. And he has a little picture here, a little diagram of how he lifts up the phone with two hands backwards and so forth and so on. Alright, you'll figure out how to do it bishinui. And he quotes Rav Yitzchak Yosef, right, that's the chief rabbi for the Sfaradim, the son of Rav Avadi Yosef, who says that Adam shenilkecha mimenu bedikas dam lekorona chala olav chova lio zamin b'shabes v'lanos b'telefon b'shinui. So he's required, once he took the test, to be available to pick up the phone when they call him, if they call him, hopefully they won't call him, and he should pick up the phone b'shinui. Rav Zilberstein goes a step further, and he writes al cholel anot al kol ha'shelot shishaluhu, and he points out that sometimes they call you twice. The first time they call you is just to notify you that you tested positive, and then they have another group, I don't know if it's the Shabak or whoever it is, and they'll call you to ask you questions. They'll interrogate you over the phone, 1,001 questions, where you've been, and you know, so forth and so on. Kidei lahazir is called Misha Shoha Bisvivoso, to make sure that anyone else who came in contact with you, if you tested positive, would have to be very, very careful and go into quarantine. Then Rav Zilberstein has a whole discussion about what we call here in Israel, Gal Sheni, Baruch Hashem, in Canada and in Australia. You don't know what this is all about. You've probably heard about it and read about it, but we have another wave here in Israel. and the numbers are incredibly high. Thank God, I think there are perhaps less, at least percentage-wise, less critical patients. I don't know, not sure. But there are plenty of critical patients, and the death rate has gone up. We're way beyond 400. And I remember when my wife went to America, she was at her father's funeral. At that time, they were talking 200, 220. Now they're past 400. So he writes that in the Gal HaSheni, this psak is even more binding than it was in the first round. And if he doesn't participate by answering the phone, Alul Ligrom Meot Meitim. I mean, he really gets dramatic here, that he, by not answering the phone, he may cause the death of hundreds of people. I find that a little bit of a hyperbole, but that's what he says. He says, Kol malacha sha'osa b'mos ha'chol k'ragil, any malacha that he would have to do during the weekday, he does it b'Shabbos b'shinui. So that's one school of thought. Now, against this school of thought that's represented by, in the Sephardic world, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, in the Ashkenazic world, by Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, the two Yitzchaks, we'll call them, we have a whole cadre of poskim who tell you not to answer the phone. Now, let me be honest with you. Again, you know, I told you I like to cover the page and come up with my what I think might guess the answer. I can't begin to understand why this man has to know on Shabbos that he tested positive. Vasa geferlich. What would be tragic if he finds out after Shabbos? He's anyway in bidud. By definition, anyone who takes a test for corona is a suspect that he may have come down with corona. And the rules here, the laws here, are absolutely binding and very strict that he has to be quarantined. So what nuance of a difference does it make whether he finds out at 12 p.m. on Shabbos afternoon or at 12 midnight on Motzi Shabbos that he has tested positive? So let me just read you one line from the Osrim, which again, if you happen to have the pages, it's page 2. And it's on the right side, and it's number 2. And he writes in the name of Shmuel Eliezer Stern, one of the Avos Bezdin of the Batei Orah, Osir Lanos LeTelephone LeKabbalat HaTotzot B'Shabbat Kevon Shehu Arei Nimtza B'Didud B'Chol Ofen. He is in a state of quarantine in any event. So why does he have to know? But that's only half the story. As we said before, we have to track down those people who may have come in contact with him and notify them that they have to go into quarantine. So he writes the following, and I'm begging you to help me with this because I can't figure it out. He says, "Uklape misha haya b'svivosav," and if you're talking about anyone who may have been in close contact with you, we'll use the word you here, Yochel lahazir oso liachar Shabbos. Why can't he just tell him after Shabbos? Here I'm lost. I can't begin to understand what he means. What do you mean you'll notify him after Shabbos? 12 hours or maybe 24 hours will go by, and this fellow who may have davened with you in shul just a few days ago, he may have hugged you and kissed you, I don't know. I mean, again, there's social distancing, but not everyone, you know, we had the Shomer P'soyim Hashem at the beginning, this before you joined me from Toronto. There may be a ton of people out there who have to know now that they may have gotten infected by you if you're the one who infected positive. What does he mean when he says, "Uklapi misha haya b'svivoso, hu yachol lizoyer liachar Shabbos"? Notify him after Shabbos? Is there no pikuach nefesh? I came up with a theory, because again, all I have is this one line in front of me, that goes the following. your obligation, if you tested positive, is not to run around, you know, take the next, but we don't have too much public transportation in our jobs, but take the next, you know, cab and run around looking for all your friends and so forth. So you're in Bedidut and you'll stay in Bedidut. Yeah, but your obligation is to pick up the phone and notify the powers to be. The authorities will run around trying to track down these people. Maybe they'll, you know, travel to the shuls or wherever they'll go, make announcements. And we got to stop this magefa as best as we can and as soon as we can. So I was thinking the following. The people, let's give names. Let's say Reuven tests positive. Shimon was with Reuven yesterday and they were hugging and kissing. I don't know. They were in shul together. Okay, so Reuven tests positive. Now, at this point, Reuven is in quarantine. So let me ask you the following. Has Shimon been infected by Reuven? Has he not been infected by Reuven? We don't know. Now, if he has been infected, then he'll find out tonight after Shabbos that he has to go for a test to find out whether he was infected. As far as Shimon is concerned, whether he was infected or not, klape atzmo, it makes no difference whether he knows today on Shabbos or he'll find out tonight after Shabbos. Meaning, his knowledge of the fact that he has to be tested to determine whether he may have been affected by Reuven is not urgent, meaning there's no difference to whether he finds that out on Shabbos or Motzi Shabbos. Now we get to the next point. But if Shimon will find out on Shabbos that there is a serious statistical probability that he himself was infected by Reuven, and again, I don't know what the statistical probability is, maybe it's 50%, maybe it's less, he now might be infecting other people. Correct? And I have no doubt that this is what Rav Zilberstein and Rav Yosef would be arguing. Let's get the notification over to Shimon, because Shimon has to be careful that he's not infecting anyone else. But let me ask you another question. And again, tell me if I'm crazy, but Shimon was in contact with Levi. So watch what happens. Reuven tests positive on Shabbos. Lama Zogin on Thursday, he was together with Shimon. Levi was together with Shimon on that very same day, Thursday. Does Levi have to go into quarantine? Yeah, I'm just going to joke and say that this is what's called in halacha, I don't mean this seriously, not bar not, if you're familiar with it, right? The milk went into the fish, and then he cooked the fish with cheese, with meat, and so forth and so on. It's not bar not. This is what you call ein l'davar sof. Now again, I may be totally wrong in my premise, but I think that Levi does not have to go into bididut. Shimon has to go into bididut because he came in close contact with an infected corona patient. Shimon might be well-meaning if he would notify some of his other friends, but I don't even think he has to do that. I think Shimon just has to get himself tested. Now, if Shimon tests positive, then we go into high gear. And we have to figure out who was in contact with Shimon from the earliest date that he may have contracted this disease. But it doesn't seem to me, and tell me please if I'm wrong, that because Shimon has to be quarantined, he was in contact with Reuven, that Levi has to be in quarantine. So that the only relevance to Shimon finding out that Reuven tested positive is to guarantee, A, that Shimon will go into quarantine, and that he, Shimon, will be tested to find out if he tests positive. None of that is pikuach nefesh. Why? Because as far as Shimon's own personal status is concerned, what difference does it make if he finds out on Shabbos or after Shabbos? He just needs to be tested. Ella what? Shimon may have a contact with Levi, etc., etc. That's not called pikuach nefesh. Because if it were called pikuach nefesh, then the entire state of Israel, and some are advocating, should go into bidud. Because everybody got in contact with everybody at some point. I don't know if you could ever get to a point in which you could say, well, we had no contact. I mean, again, it's theoretically possible because everybody is in quarantine, you know, self-quarantine. That's the best I can do over here. In any event, if you have this page, which is again page 2, and you could fast forward to the top of the second column, he quotes Rav Sariel Rosenberg and other Gedolei Horah who came to the same conclusion as Rav Stern. Osur lanos l'telephone, you're not allowed to answer the phone on Shabbos to get the results of the test. And he says that since they will only call you on Shabbos if they know, I'm saying, it, since they know you're a Sabbath observer, they will only call you on Shabbos if you tested positive. Nimtza, Sheberega, this is line 2 on the left column, Sheberega Sheroa Shemachaygim Elov B'Shabbos, Hanivda Kvar Yodea, he automatically knows that the answer is positive, and he's going to be very strict about bidud. And there's no heter to be machal Shabbos to pick up the phone and get the answer because he's already figured out the answer. And now we're up to the machlekes ha'iturim, you know, the Shabbat. They're going to try to figure out, you know, where he may have had contact. He says techapes oto v'igrom chil Shabbos machlekes shelo one b'telefon. He says that these agencies, right, these representatives of the various agencies, if you don't answer the phone, they might have to get into a car and come to find you in order to track down the others. So maybe you would have to answer the phone in order to prevent them from traveling on Shabbos. And he says no. He says, Mimonafshach. He says that, he says that if, let's just see if I can work this out. If the situation is such that this person who's being sent by the authorities to track you down on Shabbos, if he is fulfilling his obligation of pikuach nefesh, because he may prevent someone from being infected by this virus, then he's not going to be violating Shabbos at all. So what do you care if he's going to come and drive to your house? If on the other hand, he's a person who couldn't care less about Shabbos, then you don't have to violate the Shabbos for the sake of preventing someone who decides that he will violate the Shabbos. So again, we don't know how to define that, you know, automobile trip of this person who represents the health authorities. We don't know whether to call that pikuach nefesh or not. But no matter how you slice the cake, that's not your problem, Mr. Reuven. Why? Because if it's pikuach nefesh, and somehow they can limit, you know, the spread of this disease by coming to get you and track you down, So then let them do that. I mean, you're not in any way causing any Chil Shabbos. And if on the other hand, you know, this is not a situation where the halacha would justify this trip, but nevertheless, this person who is appointed by, you know, the authorities to drive and track you down, he's going to violate the Shabbos, then that's his problem. You don't have to violate the Shabbos by answering the phone in order to prevent him from violating the Shabbos. Now, we ran out of time, so we're going to have to end, but I just want to say, in summarizing, that this is a really, you know, really thick, heavy kind of question. I'll just very quickly, in order to wrap this up, read to you summarize very quickly on the last page. He says that what comes out of our discussion is that answering the phone on Shabbos entails a number of different prohibitions, some of which are electricity issues, others are mukta issues, and even if it's an automatic answering service, the Dibur itself might be an issue. And Nechleku Poskei Zmanenu, there's a major controversy amongst the Poskim in our time. The Matirim say that you have to answer the phone, and you have to get the results of your test, and you have to answer all the questions that it will ask you. It's a pikuach nefesh situation, and it's a sakana for thousands of people, and you should answer the phone with a shinui. There's another school of thought that says you're not allowed to answer the phone on Shabbos. Now, you should know already that the results are positive because you got that, you know, that phone call. You don't have to answer the phone to know that you're positive. And the fact that you might cause Chil Shabbos because of the shliach that's going to be sent to track you down, he says, you're not the one who caused him to violate the Shabbos. He made that decision on his own. And if it's pikuach nefesh, then ein chinami, you certainly didn't cause him to violate the Shabbos. He ends this by discussing a chole, a person who doesn't feel well, and he wants to know whether or not he should answer the phone in order to try to speak to some authority from the health department, from the health authorities, to find out if he has to go to the hospital. Meaning, are his symptoms severe enough or indicative enough that he should go to the hospital? And he says, according to the poskim who are matir, answering the phone with a shinui in order to get the results of the test, then likewise, he would answer the phone on Shabbos to find out whether he has to go to the hospital. And in all cases, if he's violating the Shabbos because of this possible pikuach nefesh, then he has four possible ways of implementing this Chil Shabbos in the following order. First is Amir Lenochri, if he could tell a guy to do it for him. Secondly is Amir Lekotan, and he says, I prefer that the Kotan is not your son, because you have to raise him. Third is a Melacha B'Shinui, and, you know, like we said before, he should figure out how to do a Shinui. He has a couple of possibilities here with different diagrams. And number four, two people should pick up the phone simultaneously. That's called Shnayim Shasu. Now let me just say a few words about next time. Next week is Erev Tisha B'Av. Am I correct about that? If anybody could shake their head and just affirm that next week on Wednesday is Erev Tisha B'Av. I don't hear any answers. David, am I right that next Wednesday is Erev Tisha B'Av?
Yes. Yeah, it is.
All right. So let's make up to meet 2 weeks from today.
Yeah.
Because Erev Tisha B'Av is a little bit problematic. And
it's also to learn to pass besides.
Correct. And I'm having such a good time with these Shilas that it probably is also. Even though, again, you know, these are tragic issues. But now, I have a number of possibilities for the next meeting. So let's be in touch. One of them, again, is I'd like to get back to the monetary issues, you know, with cancellations and so forth and so on. But I need to get your feedback. You know, those are complicated issues of Choshen Mishpat. They tickle my brain and give me a chance to review some of the basics of Bav Metzia and Choshen Mishpat. You know, if you cancel the order for catering and whether you have to pay tuitions and if you put down money.
Exactly.
So I need your feedback on that.
Yeah.
Okay, then?
Was a license say, and you're right, so that's different than an SA. But the
right.
thing is, it's an Isra SA, it's not really a license say
right.
per se.
It's an Isra SA. It's even right. it's even a little less severe than a Losa SA, but if the prohibition is to free a slave, then under these conditions, yeah. if the halacha is more lenient for the sake of Tefillah B'Tzibur and so forth, then it's not considered that you violated the Isra of freeing your slave. But in the case of an essay, and this is, again, a big chiddush for me, the thrust of the essay is that you should have the essay. You should, you know,
right.
the fact that we exempt you from the essay, that doesn't mean that you fulfill the essay. And the will of the Torah, which is inherent in the essay, is that you fulfill the essay. And that puts the essay on a higher level than the losa.
But the thing is, you're in a sense being over, you're giving up on that essay.
No, David, you're right. But what we have to assume is that if in the ultimate shikul and the weighing of the positive,
yeah.
if the halacha tells you that in this case you're not considered violating the law, then what's happening is that you haven't in any way undermined the will of the Torah. You know, the will of God as it personifies itself in the Torah. Mashenkin, in the case of an essay, the Torah really wants that essay to be fulfilled. Again, it's a svara. You have to think it over. I'm just, you know, you have the sheet, so you can print it out. Again, I would encourage anyone who has this possibility to collect the sheets over the course of all our meetings and put them all into one classer, as we call it here, you know, some one kind of a loose leaf notebook, because it's really fascinating. My son tells me that they just recently published a book, a sefer of 300 or 250 pages, that somebody collected all the tshuvas on Corona. Not all the tshuvas, but a whole bunch of tshuvas on Corona. So I'm hoping if I can get my hands on the sefer. My son tells me that they're selling it outside the Mir Yeshiva. He was able to flip through the table of contents, and one of the issues that they're dealing with, which is an issue in Hilchas Tefillah, is absolutely fascinating for those who are learning Daf Yomi, because they want to know about a mechitza that's not a mechitza. What does that mean, it's not a mechitza? We have certain imaginary mechitzas that you can't even see them with the naked eye. So we have something called Paris Merubala Omed, and we have different cases of Godachas Mechitzas. I'm not going to go into all the details. Now, the question is, he needs the mechitza for something, but it's going to mess him up as far as getting a minion together, because then there are five people on one side of the mechitza and five people on the other side of the mechitza. Now, this is a famous sugi of migu. Migu means that once I establish something as a mechitza, then it has the status of a mechitza. Do I have the right to say, well, I only had in mind that this should be a mechitza for X, but not for Y? I mean, very fascinating issue in Hilchas Tefillah. He says it's very relevant to sukkah, because you can have a mechitza in sukkah that's an imaginary mechitza, and it will be machshir your sukkah, so now you can eat in that sukkah and be yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah. But once I recognize that mechitza, if I have people inside the sukkah and people outside the sukkah, they're separated by a partition, they cannot integrate into one tzibur. Very fascinating, profound halachic issue. Okay, then. I'm going to thank you all for coming, and we should hear good news.